you know, the there was always friction back and forth between LSU and Baton Rouge, and we had fought very hard to get the PhD program there, which the Baton Rouge campus had opposed. One would expect that. But we also had some good collaborations with at the same time that all this stuff was going on. We also had some fairly good collaborations with people on the Baton Rouge campus as well. There was a fair amount of back and forth in those days. And we also had very good working relationships with the chemists at Tulane and some of them at Loyola. And in fact, in the 70s, there was a really what I would consider to be very active, very vital academic brew, if you will, in New Orleans between University of LSU New Orleans and Tulane and Loyola. A lot of interaction between the physics departments, a lot of interaction between the chemistry departments. That, I understand, has pretty much disappeared today. Loyola's programs have sort of dissipated. Tulane went through some very bad times. I understand they're coming back now fairly well. But in those days, it really was a very vital kind of a place. And there were very good symposiums going on all the time. I, at that time, was a member of the review panel for the General Medical Sciences of NIH. And we were able to bring together there a major conference that review panel sponsored on bioinorganic chemistry, which is probably one of the best that's been held almost anywhere. So there was just really a lot of good stuff that went on. Things were really doing very well. The friction back and forth with respect to the Baton Rouge campus was ongoing. And about that time, because of that, the chancellor at the New Orleans campus decided that one of the ways to get around that was to change the name of the New Orleans campus, and he was the one who wanted to change it to the University of New Orleans. We kept trying to insist that regardless of the problems, UCLA would not have been what it is without having University of California as part of its name. And the faculty really wanted to keep the LSU designation. But the administration felt that it really would be better, they'd get better support out of the city, and they'd get better support out of the legislature, the Orleans legislatures and so forth, which is probably true, except that the problem is that it's a state-supported school. It's not supported by the city of New Orleans. So there was a big discussion about that. And at that time, I was chairman of the Faculty Senate. We had a major discussion about that, and we had a vote, and the faculty voted not to change the name. But the chancellor pursued it anyway, and actually got the board, the LSU board, to change it. I still think it's probably a mistake, but I think it's a mistake for the state, not necessarily for the school per se. So those were some of the political kinds of things. You know, universities are hotbeds of political issues anyway. But then in the late 70s, we had a group of faculty, a couple of them in chemistry, who decided that they were not getting their share of what was going on at the university. And they decided that what they wanted to do was to topple some of the deans. And it was not just in the sciences. It was a minority group, but never mind. As you know, minority groups and faculties can create major problems. But they decided that the deans had been there too long, and they all needed to be booted out. And so, what the chancellor did was to put in a review system, which said that all the deans would get reviewed every 5 years, and that they would do this. This group of dissident faculty tried to do is to be sure that the reviews all came out badly, so that you'd get a shot at taking these people out. Well, my husband was the dean of the College of Sciences at LSU New Orleans in those days. And so they attempted to attack him as well. They attacked him. They attacked the dean of the College of Business, and they attacked the dean of, I guess, the College of Education was the other one that was really sort of in their headlights. But they didn't make a lot of as much headway as they liked. So what they did was they decided to attack him by saying that, number one, my Boyd professorship and all the other things that I had received as a faculty member was only because I was the wife of the dean. And that was very unpleasant. And indeed, they actually got the Louisiana Ethics Commission involved. I don't remember whether you remember that or not, but they got the Louisiana Ethics Commission involved. And that was a very unpleasant time, no question about it. And it was always interesting to me because it's the kind of thing, it's kind of like some of the accusations and the scandals that are going on today, is that once accused of those sorts of things, there is no way to put them to bed. There simply is not. I mean, there is no way, because you're put in a position of trying to prove what you did not do. And there's no way to do that, ultimately. I mean, you know, although the university's case, I mean, the university's held a hearing and all that, that all came back correct, that there was no misdoings or any of that. And then they sued, actually, the same group sued the administration. And that finally got settled in court. And also got settled in favor of, you know, the university, that there had been no skullduggery going on or whatever. But the problem is, it doesn't make much difference. All the damage has been done anyway. So that was unpleasant, to say the least. When I was offered a position by the Dean of Engineering to come back to LSU as Boyd Professor of Material Science. He was trying to get a material science program started at LSU. I did. I decided that it would be better to move back to the other campus and divide this thing and just get out of that. Two problems with that. One was that to try to develop that material science program required real cooperation between engineering, chemistry, and physics. And with all of our skill, we couldn't get that, to be honest. It never got high enough on anybody's priority list to make it actually work. So I think that was a big mistake, because I think it was an area in which LSU had some real horsepower, if it could have been put, because there was a really high-quality group in solid-state physics. You had some very good, well-known, world-class solid-state spectroscopists in chemistry, and those plus, to be honest, the engineering college didn't really back it either, because it meant that you had to have cooperation between mechanical engineering and electrical engineering. They didn't perform very well either. And there was just no way to get it done. What the university wanted to do was to compete for a materials research center. And actually, if we could have gotten a proposal put together in which we could have gotten those three groups of people to participate, I think we would have gotten it, because it was in an era in which they were trying to do a better geographic distribution of some of those kinds of facilities. And I think LSU would have competed very, very well. But we just couldn't. And whether we would have been able to, you know, with another couple of 3 years effort, I don't know.
Was your role mostly research
direction
or management of the program?
Well, it was to try to manage. It was to try to develop that program, actually. And then the research piece was there. And then the other was, I actually taught classes in mechanical engineering. I taught their material science classes, which are nothing more than solid-state chemistry, frankly. And I actually taught some classes for chemistry as well. We taught some advanced spectroscopy classes, that graduate courses that were taken by the graduate students in chemistry.
Did you have any feeling of discomfort of being identified with engineering?
No, not at all. In fact, the difference between chemistry and engineering is not high anyway. If you read, it's really funny to me. We now have this enormous argument going on about what basic research is and what applied research is and all this kind of stuff. And you have these people who define basic research as that sort of research which is done with no thought about what its value is going to be. Well, I think that's hilarious because I don't believe I have ever read a chemistry proposal which does not, at least in the first three paragraphs, set out why, that if this works, it's either going to let you do something you haven't been able to do before, it's going to give you insight into some practical problem everybody's interested in. You know what I'm saying? I think it's just, and when you think about it, there's theoretical people in chemistry, but you take the polymer chemists and all these sorts of people, there's not that much difference, frankly. And I like engineering anyway. I like the applied applications and the fact that you can take something that you've done and you can actually see that develop into something that the engineers can take and build something from. I think that's kind of a fun thing to do.
Before you took that position as trying to create the material science program at the university, had you been involved in any engineering applications in your research?
We had done some. For example, we had some major research money from the Navy. And we had been looking at their anti-fouling coatings and trying to figure out ways to improve those, both from the point of view of giving them better compounds, but also figuring out better ways to make them adhere, figuring out ways to get them to release slowly. We did some of the early work on the organotins, which, as you know, are still being used because they're the best material around, but people don't like them very much because they're an environmental problem as well. So we had done some work. We had gotten into doing some surface spectroscopy where we could actually look at those sorts of coatings and make predictions about how to make them better and whatever. So those, although it wasn't an engineering project per se, it was all close. Awfully close.
Well, after you had been at LSU and the appointment in engineering with material science for two or three years.
Yeah, 2 years, right.
2 years, you left academia. Was that solely because of the attractiveness of the industrial offer, or was it frustration with trying to bring these disparate groups together,
yeah,
or both?
It would be hard to say that the frustration of trying to make that work at LSU at that particular time didn't have something to do with it. But the most important reason for doing it was that the challenge of doing something like that was just not able. I just wasn't able to turn that down. I had no idea where I could be successful or not. I'd certainly never managed anything of that magnitude.
Do you have any idea how UOP Signal happened to identify
that
job?
I had been very active in the American Chemical Society. And in fact, I had been chairman of the board of the American Chemical Society. I'd been elected to the board in 1972. In fact, I was the first woman ever elected to the ACS board, which is kind of interesting. I was chairman of the board in 1978 and again in 1980. And at the time that I was chairman of the board in 1978, Herman Bloch, who came from UOP, who was a director of research at UOP, had been president of the ACS, I was chairman the year he was chairman of the board. I guess I was chairman of the publications committee. But I got to know Herman very well, and when they began to look for a new vice president for research at UOP, it was really interesting. They had had UOP is a very interesting company. It's a company that depends on fairly fundamental work because they depend on licensing their technology which means that you have to have the best technology and you have to have it first. There's no place for second place players, and they license process technology all around the world. And they had had a succession of people as research directors who had been chemists or at least very chemically oriented. And in the 70s, they had hired from GE a person who was known for his management skills rather than his technical skills. And because they thought they needed to manage the thing better and all that sort of thing. Well, it turned out to be not a very good choice. And so the president of UOP decided that to cure that, he had to have a chemist. He did not want an engineer. But he wanted somebody who actually had had some, who was willing to work with engineers every day on a day-to-day basis. And Herman actually was the one who sent my name forward. And the first that I knew of it was that Val Hensel, who of course is probably the most famous person ever to come out of UOP, because he's the guy who invented platforming. And in fact, you know, did the very first commercial use of platinum catalysts in refining. He at that time was the senior vice president for technology for UOP, which meant he looked at, they had a number of other companies, other activities, but the old UOP, the refining and petrochemical part, had a vice president for research and the process division, what they call the process division. And he called me up one day and he said, would you be interested in talking about an industrial job? And I said, Val, I have no idea. I never thought about it. I said, I'm perfectly happy with what I'm doing. I've got good research money. I've got good students. He said, well, I want to come down and talk to you. Well, at that time, he was doing some work with the Exxon refinery in Baton Rouge. And he said, I've got to come to Baton Rouge next week. I've got an appointment out at the refinery. I would like to have some time. And I said, fine. So I picked him up, and we went, spent about 3 hours discussing this thing. And he said, I really would like for you to at least come and interview. So I said, well, I talked to Bill, and we said, okay, what the heck. So I went up to interview, and it was just... It was just kind of exciting. The laboratories in those days had about 500 people, and the development laboratories probably had another 500 people. But the research director actually had the 500 research people, and your job was to manage them, be sure they were doing cutting edge stuff at the same time that they passed that off and interacted with the engineering development group quick enough that you could get it developed and ready to commercialize in a time frame that would make money, is what it's all about. And it was just exciting. And it still absolutely amazes me that I went once to interview, gave a seminar, and I had done some work on, UOP actually did most of the early work on the automotive catalysts as well. And they had tried ruthenium. Ruthenium is a very good material in an automotive catalyst. The only problem with it is that it oxidizes very quickly. And so it's not usable. So we had done some fundamental work on again using ruthenium MOSFET to prove that as you cycle those, every time you cycled it, you got more oxide than you did the time before, and it ultimately over about 100 cycles, you just couldn't recover it. But I decided that these guys were all experts in catalysis, and it would be a mistake to do that catalysis talk. So instead of doing that one, I did the one on the surface spectroscopy with the 10 compounds and things like that, because they had not at that time begun to use things like ESCA and surface spectroscopy to look at their catalytic materials, and it seemed to me that this would be really a nice thing to do. So I gave this seminar, and it seemed to work out very well. I had a lot of conversations with the various people. And so I came back, they invited me back, and I came back the second time about 3 weeks later. And I had gone over to visit with folks, and I came back to the president's office, and he just sat down and wrote me out an offer. And so I said, well, give me a couple of weeks and I'll decide. So I went back and talked to Bill, and Bill had, my husband had left the deanship 2 years earlier and had gone back to physics, and in that time he had also had always wanted to paint. So he had spent 2 years working with a real accomplished artist in New Orleans who's probably one of the best known restorers in the country of oil paintings, and really enjoyed it. So he said, look, if you want to take it, do it, and we'll move to Chicago. And they worked out a way to get him a teaching position up there, and he said, no, I don't want to do that. I want to paint for a couple of years, and if it turns out to be good stuff, that's what I want to do. So I took it, and I took it primarily because it was just a challenge you couldn't turn down. I had no idea whether I didn't know enough to know that I couldn't do it. Okay. And to this day, I still don't have any idea why they really, you know, how this president managed to get me hired, because UOP, the process division of those days, was managed by hard-nosed chemical engineers, all of whom had field work, all that sort of thing, hard hat guys, to say the least, and had never seen a woman in a position like this. You can't imagine. I mean, this was a shock, to say the least, I'm sure. And a chemist to boot, you know. I mean, you know, give me a break, a university chemist, for God's sakes. But we got along fine, actually, after we got up there. And like I say, I didn't know enough to know I couldn't do it.
Well, apparently the president was unusually astute, because after you had been there, what, 2 years,
yeah,
you were selected as the industrial scientist of the year.
That's true. That's true, which is still a mystery to me. But anyway.
Do you have a clear idea of what activity you did that brought about that particular award and recognition?
You know, I think maybe the thing that did that more than anything else was the fact that we were, you know, this whole re-engineering that's been going on in the chemistry, in the industrial chemistry laboratories and things, and in industry in general in the last few years. At UOP, we had begun to do that much, much earlier. And the reason was that UOP makes its money by designing a process which it can license, and then designing the best catalyst to go in that process. So what they do is they get you coming and going. You license their process, and then you sell into that process your catalyst. And you can ask a premium price for that catalyst if it makes that process run 2% better. Because, a 2% better in a refinery where you're doing millions of barrels is a huge profit line, okay? So the whole deal at UOP was to do fundamental work in the catalysis area, get that converted to something the guys could actually manufacture, that the process guys could manufacture as quickly as you could, you know, do the iteration. And so we had iteration going on between some very fundamental chemists and some applications engineers all the time. There's all kinds of frictions associated with that, okay? But I did two things when I first came. One was I was appalled that the laboratory had no computing equipment, or very little. They were still in 1980, they were still using punch cards that went to the mainframe IBM machine across in the administration building to do scientific problems. So the first thing we did was to begin to buy PCs and network things, deck computers and a whole bit to computerize it, which immediately gave our scientists enormous improvements in productivity and what have you. And the second was to bring to it much more in the way of analytical technology, so that you could analyze what you had and not have to do so much empirical work. Because if I can do the analysis properly and not have to run 6 pilot plants to find that out, the savings are enormous. And so what we did was we began to think about how you could, in the research part, how you could do your work in such a way that you cut down both on the time and the cost in the pilot plant facilities. And I think that was probably the reason for it. And we had a lot of fun doing it. And today UOP is probably as good as anybody at doing that. And a lot of the things that I started there, they've continued and in fact moved beyond even where we were. And I've just, but it was an exciting place. In fact, of all of the jobs I've ever had, I enjoyed being research director at UOP better than any of the rest.
Company mergers change the character of your appointment and your locale.
Lord,
comment
yes.
a bit about
yeah,
that.
The 80s was the, in fact, it looks like the 90s are going to now be the same, or at least the back end of the 90s are going to be the same. But the 80s were really a time of all kinds of reorganization, acquisitions, whatever. And when I went to UOP, UOP was a standalone company. It was one of the signal companies, true enough. But it was managed, the signal companies managed the four companies they had as a portfolio. And each company was standalone. They owned UOP at that time when I went. They owned Ampex, the people that made magnetic audio tapes. And they owned Mack Truck. They owned the Garrett Aerospace Company, which made small jet engines. And they owned 49% of the Los Angeles Angels. Gene Autry owned the 51%. But that's what they were. And each of the, and in fact, UOP had a board of its own, managed separately. In the early 80s, the whole business, the theory and all that, was such that people thought you didn't get any synergism out of that, and that you needed to have a much more hands-on operating headquarters kind of group that managed all these things. Well, the old signal company headquarters in La Jolla, California had, when I first went there, 75 people. It was about a $4 billion company in those days, because each of these single companies were about $1 billion apiece. That was it. It had 75 people. In 1992 and 93, they merged with a company called Wheeler Brader Fry, which was the CEO of that was Mike Dingman. And their principal financial officer was Paul Montrone. And they were experts at coming into what they considered to be slow, laggard companies, shaping them up, sort of ruthlessly doing that, and then getting them ready to compete in what was then, you know, moving on towards the global economy. So they merged with UOP, with the signal companies primarily, and the signal companies' executives' motivation for that was to get the kind of management skill that was required to manage the company rather than just have it managed at each level. And that was interesting, to say the least, because they did not understand UOP at all. I mean, you're now talking about people who had managed manufacturing companies primarily. For example, in their bucket, they had Fry Copy, which was an old company in Iowa, in Des Moines, Iowa, that made, they started off in life making carbon paper from carbon black. At the time that the merger, they made they still made carbon paper. They made airline tickets, and they made typewriter ribbons, and they made computer ribbons, and anything that you use. Okay. And they had and the reason it was called Wheeler Brader was there was a company down in South Bend, Indiana, called Wheeler Brader, and they made a big cleaning device they called a Wheeler Brader that had a big rotational brush and so forth on the bottom, and you use it to clean floors and stuff. So they manufactured that, and so here you had a group of people who were used to taking over companies that were old-line manufacturers, you know, taking out stuff, shaping them up, redoing the management, and parts of UOP were like that too, because UOP had made a lot of money, and so they'd acquired some companies they had no business having. That's also true. I mean, we had a company that made, believe it or not, UOP in those days had a company that made seats for farm tractors. And we had one that made these things that go in airplanes, the carts that go up and down the aisles and all that kind of stuff. So the first thing, but the part of the company that actually made money was the UOP Process Division, which was the one that did this really fundamental research, very high quality development, licensed their technology. The only manufacturing we did was to make catalysts, and the cost of the manufacturing was not truly an issue in what we never priced them by cost anyway. You priced them by what the market would bear, which had nothing to do with their cost, actually, because their market value was the intellectual property they represented, not the cost of the materials that went into them. So you got these guys who are used to, you know, here they come, and they look at this UOP, and they decide that they should do the same sorts of things they had done before. Well, this was a disaster. I mean, you just can't imagine. Fortunately, Paul Montrone, in particular, recognized that this was a different kind of an operation. And Mike Dingman was a guy who was really interesting. He actually liked the laboratory and had a real interest in it. So we were able to manage to, for the UOP Process Division, we were able to keep most of what we were doing, and we kept them from decimating.